Today, inside Lebanon, a country in crisis.
The town of Akkar is in far northern Lebanon. It's about 5 kilometres from the Syrian border. It's a desolate place. There's not much going on in the middle of the day during a good year, but this year, in the midst of an economic implosion and the corona crisis, Akkar was more forlorn and almost foreboding than I'd ever seen it. Market stalls were closed, shops were shuttered. Yet amongst it all, we found a wedding shop with a dog-eared sign out the front, which had been there for the best part of 20 years, and a few tattered wedding dresses in the window. And we walked inside and made ourselves known to a lady called Suzanne Hamoud, who for 15 years had owned that shop. Suzanne greeted us warmly, as people do even during a crisis in this part of the world, and we sat down with her and her sister, and we asked her, how is business? She began to tell us stories of how, for the first time in her career, business had been so bad that she was having brides come to her wanting to sell their wedding dresses back to them because they could no longer afford food in their homes. In northern Lebanon, a wedding dress is a prized possession, and it's certainly kept as an heirloom by many households. And for new brides with their mothers to come back into the shop and beg to be able to sell them back was something that Suzanne had not seen before. And it's something that is not typically done. And she was saying that this, more than anything she's seen, is a sign of just how desperate things have become.
The story that The Guardian's Middle East correspondent Martin Chulov is telling is not just about one bridal shop in northern Lebanon, but the entire country. On a road trip with photographer Achilles Zavallis, he saw scenes of economic despair everywhere, from shops to homes, businesses to hospitals. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how has Lebanon been brought to the brink of collapse? Martin, what is happening in Lebanon right now? Why is the country in crisis?
Over the last 4 months, we've seen the currency has plunged by up to 80%. Food prices have tripled, so have those of other essential goods. And at the same time, we're seeing widespread layoffs across all sectors of the economy. And we are now in a situation where the middle classes of Lebanon, those who could comfortably afford, say, a trip abroad every year or so, are now facing serious food insecurity. And that is something that hasn't been seen in Lebanon, not just since the end of the Civil War, but potentially since the years of independence, which started in 1943.
You live in the capital, Beirut, along with a third of Lebanon's population. How has the economic situation changed daily life there?
Well, it really is a city that seems to have lost its soul, lost a sense of itself. I mean, even in bad times gone by over recent years, there was a resourceful spirit. There was a can-do attitude. People just making good of life. It's been part of the appeal for visitors and citizens alike for so long. That seems to have gone in many ways. It's not just the shuttered shops that we see along nearly every boulevard.
How will I be able to buy products again? My shop is empty. It's a catastrophe.
Every week, it seems that there are more rental signs on vacant homes.
Begging for money or sifting through garbage and waste. Scenes that have become part of daily life in Lebanon in recent months.
Add to that the electricity, which has always been the bane of people's life in Beirut. Even in a good year, you can get by on 12 hours a day of city power if you're lucky. This summer, we're down to 2 to 4 hours per day, and the rest needs to run off generators, which are expensive, prohibitively so.
What we have a problem is the washing machine, we have problems with the freezing, we have to throw out half of the cheese and the meat. Plus, we don't have AC during night or day.
The public health system here is really struggling under an increasing caseload at the moment. The private health system is doing just as badly because many hospitals have closed down. They can't afford to pay their staff.
And what about food, Martin? Are people able to get access to basic necessities?
It must be said, there is food for the moment on the shelves, but what we did see in Tripoli, Lebanon's second city, were bread queues, regular Lebanese lining up for free bread at charity centres in the city, and I've never seen anything like that before.
So you've got the cost of goods going up hugely, but the amount that people earn not going up at all. People just must be very frustrated. Is that something that comes through to you when you speak to people in Lebanon?
Certainly is a frustration, but it's also a despair that the dream is gone, that this mouse that roared story was a fable after all, and that this country is not able to rise from the ruins of whether it be the Civil War or whatever starting point you like. The overwhelming feeling is that this is broken and that the best option is to leave the country. One of the people we've met in the past week is the director of the National Theatre Company, an impressive woman called Nidal Ashgar, who has been a director of the company for the last 40 years. And she said to us that there is no hope in the city. The Beirut that she knew was now a very different place, darkened and emptying and a little bit menacing as well.
People have no hope anymore. They don't trust anybody anymore. They have nothing to dream about, not in the present tense, nor in the future sense. Khalas, what are we going to dream? What are we going to eat? When is the electricity going to come?
Can you explain why this is happening?
The reasons, more or less, that we're in this situation are a combination of economic mismanagement and political corruption.
Where does the story of the country's financial problems begin? What do we need to understand about Lebanon's history to make sense of the political corruption that exists there today?
There are many starting points to the story, but let's start with 1943. You had a country which was more or less arbitrarily defined. Its borders were arbitrarily defined. Just down the hill from Syria, Turkey to the north, what would soon be Israel 5 years later to the south, and 18 different sects in this tiny little country on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean. The Druze in the mountains, the Sunni Muslims more or less to the north, the Shia Muslims who were then largely in the south and the east of the country, and the Christians who are on the mountains near Beirut. And that left the capital itself as a cosmopolitan hub of many different sects and clans. People more or less got by, and through the 50s and the 60s, relatively good decades.
Here, north meets south, and Beirut is the gateway to the east.
We got through to the 70s, and the civil war in Lebanon more or less started in 1975. It was fought along many fault lines over the next 15 years, but the early years were the Christians of this country fighting the Palestinians, who had taken a very strong political position in Lebanon, and they'd been using the country as an arena for their cause vis-a-vis the Israelis. Throughout the second half of the 70s, those fault lines diverged. The Syrian military was involved in Lebanon. The Israeli military were partly involved as well. And there were Shia sects, Christian sects, Druze as well, who had all formed their own militias. And at various parts of that half decade, they were at each other.
The arrangement, as it was known, that careful balance in government between the country's religious factions, has collapsed.
From 1982 onwards, a Shia militant group, Hezbollah, gathered steam. By the end of the civil war, Hezbollah was a force to be reckoned with. In the 30 years since, it's been ever more so. They've mobilized right throughout the region and other parts of the world, and they have developed political allies, particularly amongst half of the Christians in this country, which at the end of the day have led them to become the most formidable political bloc in Lebanon. So we've had sects and clans and competing interests in Lebanon who have never been able to unite under the national flag.
Since the end of the civil war in 1990, how has Lebanon been governed?
Well, the political agreement that ended the war apportioned power along sectarian lines. The essence of it was that the prime minister would be a Sunni Muslim. The speaker of the parliament would need to be a Shia Muslim. The president would be a Christian. Those three figures apportioned power right throughout the country. Within them, those three and the leader of Lebanon's Druze sect have formed extensive patronage networks in the country. And what that's meant is that the parliament has been effectively a fig leaf for the way that the state really is run, and that is that the institutions act as fiefs.
Okay, you say fiefs, but what does that actually mean? What areas of society are divided amongst these sects?
There are four big cash cows in Lebanon, which are apportioned along sectarian lines. They are fuel income and distribution, waste management, biometrics and digital technology, and there's food importation as well, all of which are run at very significant profits. Some of that money is used to buy the loyalty of people who follow them, and others is apportioned at least partly to some institutions, which just keeps them creaking over, but it doesn't ever allow them to thrive.
So these state services are being run in such a way that a minority can profit from them, but they receive very little investment. What does that mean for people in Lebanon? I mean, let's take waste management. How is that run in the country?
Waste management is a good example of how things have been done so badly. Over 25 years, it was one of the most important and lucrative tenders in the country, but it was never actually put to tender. It was always given to the one company, which didn't have to go through a competitive process to get there. In 2015, the waste management crisis reached a head.
The country's waste crisis re-emerged back in July when the biggest landfill, which served nearly half of the population, was shut down by local residents for being overused. Many claim the government knew this landfill was reaching maximum capacity for years, but failed to develop an alternative. Instead, garbage was being distributed around empty spaces, many located near residential areas and forests. Mountains of it began piling up on pavements and street corners. Angry Lebanese started taking to the streets under the slogan, "You stink," to demand solutions. And with the government failing to act, the protests quickly turned into a movement challenging the country's politicians who've been in political deadlock for more than a year.
What we did see is a new waste management supplier in 2017. But ecologically, Lebanon remains utterly ruinous. The landfills are massive and growing. There's a lot of burning of rubbish going on nationwide. I tip it down valleys and hope it goes away.
God, that's awful.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way in the world I'd let my daughter swim in the ocean off this coast. I mean, it's just hideously infected. You can just see the slime on the sea. Sewage, untreated, raw, pours out to the ocean from around the country. There are no sewage treatment plants here at all.
So from the outside, it sounds like there's quite a diplomatic sense of power sharing between these different sets in Lebanon, Martin, but actually it's just served for people to furnish their own interests rather than working together for the better of the country.
That is effectively how it has played out in Lebanon in the last 30 years, that the power sharing arrangement amongst the politicians has benefited an elite few with the networks that flow from them. But are the interests of the country itself served by the political structures and their interests at the moment? I think the overwhelming answer to that is no.
You've talked about government corruption within Lebanon, but what about the financial system? I mean, people say what is happening in the country is massive financial mismanagement. What's really going on?
Well, I think the banking system's at the centre of where we are now. Since the end of the war years, there have been a few steps taken by the political leadership to attract foreign investment, attract tourism, bring an income that was so desperately needed to rebuild the country and to put it on some kind of a solid economic footing.
It will be the beginning of a new era, an era of new economics, of a new life, of a new civilization. Hopefully that this dream is irreversible and it will never come back again.
Some decisions were made in the late 90s, one of which was to peg the Lebanese lira to the dollar. There was also a very significant growth in the banking system here. And there were large numbers of retail banks and commercial banks, and the central bank often found itself in a position of bailing out the government and relying on the commercial and retail banks to help them do that.
Over the years, governments in Lebanon have used the banking system to finance unsustainable spending. Critics say this put the money of ordinary Lebanese citizens in jeopardy.
From mid-2016, however, things did get complicated for the central bank. At that point, they needed to raise funds to cover for losses elsewhere, particularly on its own balance sheet, but elsewhere in the government. And they were offering exorbitant interest rates of 13 to 14% to commercial banks, who were then passing those rates on to retail banks because they needed to get money back from offshore, particularly the Lebanese diaspora, which is wealthy and minded to send money back home if you're earning interest such as that. Sure enough, money did come in, but it couldn't actually be serviced. And the interest rates were taking a huge drain on already dwindling revenues. And when we cast forward to late last year, 2019, when we reached a point where there was a lack of funds coming into the country, this system was exposed as a classical Ponzi. Once the accounts were tabled, we saw a $69 billion hole in the central bank's balance sheet, which was staggering, leaving the banking system unable to pay its debts.
So the government has been overspending, relying on the central bank, which in turn has been borrowing from smaller commercial banks to pay off its debts. This is unsustainable and, as you said, came to a head last year. What did the government do?
The government started to look for other ways to pass on its problems to Lebanese citizens, and one of which was to impose a tax on WhatsApp, which did not go down favourably at all with the Lebanese population. It was supposed to be a $5 a month tax. So to have that suddenly cost them $60 a year was a bridge too far. And amongst many other things, that was one of the main lightning rods for leading the Lebanese to the streets on October 17 last year.
Coming up, what happened when hundreds of thousands of people in Lebanon began to protest? So the Lebanese government were attempting to impose a tax on WhatsApp, of all things. People were furious about that and, of course, about the years of financial mismanagement in the country, which had led to this complete collapse in the system. And they took to the streets in huge numbers. What happened?
Well, these were really important, really extraordinary scenes. In the great sweep of Lebanese history, they mattered. For 3 to 5 weeks, there were upwards of 300 to 500,000 people per day taking to the streets of their cities and towns and villages, waving Lebanese flags, forgetting their primal sense of identity, whether their clan, their sect, their village, and uniting more or less as Lebanese. This was electrifying, it was real, and it was a moment of aspirational citizenship where they wanted to be not just Lebanese in a collective sense of identity, but Lebanese who existed and prospered under a functioning sovereign state. And it was something which really did paralyze the political class here, who simply didn't have a counter to it.
The autumn storms did nothing to put the people off. Instead, they gathered through the day again in huge numbers.
They do whatever they want. All of a sudden, no, the people have woken up. And also, who do you think owns all the banks? Come on, the politicians. I can name you bank by bank.
After a few weeks, the then government fell.
A key demand has been met, but it's not enough to get them off the streets. Despite Saad Hariri's resignation, thousands of people across Lebanon rallied to keep up the pressure on the government.
And a new technocratic or allegedly technocratic government was formed. And that led us into the Christmas period, after which COVID-19 quickly followed. And by February this year, the revolution itself had run out of steam. To the extent that there was a government strategy, it was just let it do so. But the sense that real change was possible was palpable.
Okay, so the protests had in some respects achieved a lot. They forced the Prime Minister to resign and he was replaced by Hassan Diab, a former education minister. During this period, did the financial situation in the country improve?
The financial problems that had become so evident in the autumn of last year, by March this year, were looming very large on the horizon. Lebanon had funded part of its government debt through a Eurobond payment, which it had always honoured through good times or bad. But it became clear that for the bond payment that was due in March, it could make that payment, but it couldn't make the second or the third because that would have tapped into an ever-diminishing series of government reserves. So a decision was taken in March to default on the bond payment, which was a very symbolic decision, and that was to say to the rest of the world and to Lebanese people themselves that we just can't do this anymore. We are effectively filing for bankruptcy. And that changed things.
Today we face a huge obligation, a debt of $1.2 billion, which is due in 2 days. These funds must be channeled to secure the basic necessities for the Lebanese people.
Lebanon's banks have borne the brunt of the protesters' fury. They've imposed strict capital controls on accounts, freezing access to cash as food prices soar.
I'm not expecting you to return the money that you took. Just be a little bit human and listen to these people dying from hunger.
There was ever more scrutiny placed on Lebanon. The IMF took an interest in the country, and they started a series of negotiations with Lebanese political leaders here in which they too demanded reforms, which would have given them enough comfort to introduce aid, which could have kick-started the economy again, along with donor money from France. So where we are 4 months later is that those negotiations have gone nowhere.
France's foreign minister didn't come to show support for Lebanon's leaders, who are asking for an international bailout to deal with the unprecedented economic crisis. Instead, Jean-Yves Le Drian delivered a firm message. Politicians will need to reform the state and end corruption.
So what we have then between the Lebanese government and the IMF is a stalemate, really, with the government digging in and not seeming to want to make reforms. Is there any way, do you think, that they might be able to reach an agreement?
I mean, I've had conversations with the former Director General of the Finance Ministry, who resigned in protest last month. Alain Bafani was in his role for 20 years, and I sat with him for 2 hours, in which he went over his role as a Lebanese government representative lining up against the IMF in negotiations. And he said he had to quit in protest because he, in good faith, could not put his name to the Lebanese position. He was of the view that there was one point in the conversation where they were close, that the Lebanese leadership was close to making the concessions that would have actually got a process underway. But when they were really put to the test, they couldn't. And he said to me that the happy, corrupt few won out at the end of the day, and that we are dealing with a genuine, hardcore, entrenched mafia system in Lebanon, which will not let go its grip on the levers of power. And that's what somebody who knows where the bodies are buried financially in Lebanon and knows how decisions are made here and knows a lot about what's been spent and by whom over so many years. If he's saying that after 2 decades and quitting the government in protest, then the country clearly has a systemic problem.
The frustration on the streets is almost daily, and talks with the International Monetary Fund have been ongoing for weeks, but still there is no bailout agreed, in large part because politicians inside the country can't agree on the scale of the losses or the required reforms.
You spoke earlier about Lebanon losing many of its former foreign backers, like Saudi Arabia, who might have been able to help in this situation. Why has that happened?
We're now at a point where Hezbollah, having taken such a prominent stake in the affairs of the state, have, in the eyes of some allies, changed the very nature of the place.
Hezbollah has gained enduring popularity, reflected in its election results. It has won seats in every parliament since 1992 and has participated in governments since 2005. There are entire parts of the country believed to be dominated by the group.
The Saudis and the Gulf states are no longer prepared to fund Lebanon to the extent that they were. In fact, the Saudis have completely walked away. The Americans have kept their funding to limited projects, such as some university scholarships and other things. And the Iranians are playing an ever-deepening role in Lebanon in terms of providing funding for Hezbollah. We're also seeing, in such a volatile environment, the Syrian regime attempt to re-establish some of its influence. So what we are potentially looking at is a changing of the regional guard, with the traditional Gulf states, who had more or less had blank checkbooks whenever things had gone bad, thinking that Lebanese politicians have lost all credibility, and the Iranians, to the best of their ability, looking to double down on their political investment in this country.
Martin, how important would an agreement with the International Monetary Fund be for Lebanon and for the people of Lebanon?
I cannot see a way forward without that. I mean, nobody can show an alternative to rapidly unlocking upwards of $15 billion in aid from the international community. Where else is it going to come from? The country produces nothing. It's a consumer economy. It's ever more in the thrall of its neighbors in Syria and to some extent Iran. there is no plan to do anything to put this country on a sovereign economic footing, and there doesn't seem to be much of an ability to do so without a huge injection of cash.
What is the future for the people of Lebanon, do you think?
Earlier this month, I spoke to a senior diplomat from one of the European states, a state that many Lebanese come and go from, and he was saying that the consulate section at the embassy had been closed for the last 3 months because of the COVID crisis and also because of the political unrest, and that the foreign ministry of that state was reluctant to reopen it because they knew that they would be getting hundreds, if not thousands, of tourist visa applications from middle-class Lebanese. He knew that they would be good visa applicants in any other year, but if they were given visas, they were going to travel and they weren't coming back. So they'd be dealing with large numbers of middle-class refugee applicants, those who have made good out of life in Beirut in difficult circumstances, but now feel that the country offers them no future or hope.
Martin, thank you very much for speaking to me.
You're welcome.
That was Martin Chulov. Read all of his brilliant reporting from across Lebanon at theguardian.com, where you can also see some beautiful photos from his trip taken by Achilles Zavalis. Today's episode was produced by Courtney Youssef, and sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.